Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
Hello, welcome back to Smash Pod. This is part two. If you want to hear part one, why not go back and listen to that? In the meantime, here's part two. I hope you enjoy. I really do.
We're too late. Well, at least he died on the job. He'd have wanted it this way.
So they have their little bath and... As going back to being a boy, going to see this,
it was just like, this is the most erotic thing I could ever imagine.
It is.
I would love to be James Bond.
Yeah. Women want him, men want to be him, especially in this particular scenario.
Yeah, and to be in those baths with all those lovely young ladies catering to your every need. Gosh, it's a terrible, terrible thing.
Awful. Misogyny.
But as a young boy... I just thought, this is the bee's knees.
Mm. But Tanaka asks Bond, who do you think would have the muscle to do such a thing? And Bond goes, well, it's obviously Spectre, in it, because it's always Spectre.
Yeah.
Who else would it possibly be? It was only in the 70s when they couldn't use Spectre anymore that they had to actually start thinking of actual villains.
Yeah, I know. But it was quite interesting, though, that Fleming came up with Spectre, because obviously in his first books it was always Smersh.
That's right.
The Russian Secret Service. Mm. And he realised, actually, towards the end of the 50s, that we weren't always going to be at war with the Russians.
Yeah.
And he needed to come up with another kind of enemy. And he was pretty prescient to come up with the idea of an international criminal organisation, which is kind of imagining the world we're in now, that they've sort of almost styled themselves on Spectre.
Mm.
But you know, that was pretty clever of him to come up with that idea and say, look, we can't just keep fighting the Russians. Let's have something else that will sort of cover all bases. And so the first few of the films are a little bit odd in they try and accommodate both Spectre and Smersh at the same time.
Yes.
Which is slightly confusing.
Well, it definitely works in From Russia with Love, because they're not the suspects. Spectre certainly aren't the suspects, because everybody involved is a Smersh agent who has unofficially defected without anybody knowing.
That really makes sense.
Mm. But it made me think, though, because you know how the sort of Daniel Craig era is, people suspect will be kind of ring fenced because it's his own thing.
Yeah,
it made me think that the Connery era and a bit of Lazenby is like that as well, because obviously by the time Diamonds Are Forever finishes, they can't use Spectre anymore. So throughout the entire Roger era, it's a whole new world of bad guys.
Yeah, and it's always the hardest thing in films is to say, well, who are going to be the villains?
Yeah.
Because things can change quickly.
Mm.
Is it in one of the Rambo films where it's like...
Yeah, Rambo 3.
With the Mujahideen.
That's right. It's dedicated to the brave fighters of them at the end.
Yeah, who were because they were fighting the Russians at the time.
And Bond does it as well in The Living Daylights.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you start to get into the catch-all territory of sort of international drug dealers, because they're all bad. But it's, you know, it is a really tricky one if you're doing these big action thrillers, is who are the villains? You know, are they always going to have to be some foreign power? You know, are they going to be, oh, we're going to do our terrorists this time? You know, and things change, and one day someone's a hero, the next day they're a villain, and vice versa. So,
well, that's where the Roger one's got it right, because you're always going to be a villain if you want to live underwater and destroy the world. And you're always going to be a villain, yes, if you want to blow up, kill every living thing on Earth apart from plants, and then come down and start again.
But, you know, how many films did they do that in?
Well,
that's on Her Majesty's Secret Service. That's
Moonraker,
Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's essentially...
Yeah. But they're classics.
Yes. And, you know, in the end, they sort of work better if it is just something that's not too tied in with current politics.
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather watch a fish-handed man trying to drown the world than a political thing about the water shortages in Bolivia in Quantum of Solace.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Is that what that was about?
I think so. I mean, much like the water in the film runs dry quite quickly.
Yes. Yes.
In the end,
and, you know, Hitchcock had it right. Why not just have a big engine noise over? I'll tell you who the villains are. I'll tell you who they're working for. Right, okay.
Yeah. Don't worry, there's a car chase in a minute.
Yeah.
So Tanaka says they're going to get quite sexy-ful with the ladies, which I thought is a very... It's the sort of thing the BFG would say about pornography. So I think that's definitely dull.
It's quite sexy-ful.
Yeah. Ooh. I'll rob Mishnol's cumber. So then he gets his meeting with Asato, and I don't think Bond's thought this through, because he says his name is Fisher. And they say, where's Williamson, the man we usually meet? And Bond just goes, oh, he fell into a pulverizer. I mean, that arouses suspicion immediately, doesn't it?
Yeah, he could have said he had a heavy cold.
Yeah, anything else than that.
Yeah.
And they scan him and he's wearing a pistol, which again doesn't seem very sensible. And he basically says, oh, well, you know, I'm interested in what you do here. But and then Azata goes, anyway, I've got work to do, so you better leave. And as soon as he leaves, he turns to his assistant, Brandt, and says, kill him.
Mm.
So not the most successful questioning mission in the world, really.
Well, it's successful in terms of our plot.
Mm. Mm.
It says, we need some other baddies. We need to see who they are. We need to set him on his tail. And we'll look forward to seeing them killed later on.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you know, people always talk about James Bond as being a spy.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a spy. He never does any actual spying. And he's not much of a secret agent either. There is, I mean, in the books particularly, there is no clever plotting.
Mm.
M says, here's a bad guy. Go and sort him out. And Bond turns up and sorts him out with physical violence.
Yeah.
There's no clever sneaking around and finding files and doing research and putting things together and following someone to get clues. None of that.
No.
And thank God it's not, because these are action thrillers. And
it would be quite boring.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that in, I won't name any names, but in at least one of the recent adult James Bond book continuations.
Yes.
The author has made the mistake of thinking that's what Bond ought to be doing. Talking to people who are looking at computers and reading files and things. You think, no, Bond just needs to turn up and fight someone.
Yes. Again, I read one, naming no names, John Gardner, where Bond has purposely been given no gadgets or weapons apart from a baton. And it was really boring.
What, like a bread roll type?
Like a bread roll, yeah. And in the end, he made a sandwich. It was really unfulfilling, ironically. After he leaves, he gets involved in a sort of drive-by shooting where he gets saved by Aki. And then the Tanaka's men come and grab the other car with a magnet and drop it off somewhere into the sea.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
And Bond has got the sort of television device in the car.
Yes.
And he's following it. And it's a clever device because it is showing this incident from several different angles, including from above. So they must have actually had a fleet of helicopters, all with cameras.
They were way ahead of the times, the Japanese.
Filming all this. But again, it's one of those moments which is absolutely ridiculous to pick a car up with a giant magnet and drop it in the sea.
Mm.
But what fun.
Oh, it's great. But there's also a sort of window into the future as well, because Tanaka's talking to him in the car on a Sony TV, And most of the Daniel Craig films were Sony, and they had Sony product placement everywhere. So it was a shape of things to come. So they go down to the dock because he wants to check out this boat called the Ningpo. And as soon as they get there, they get attacked by a forklift truck. And then we get this amazingly shot sequence because Lewis Gilbert directed this. And the rooftop fight where it's just like a helicopter shot, which is all one take. And it looks brilliant.
Yeah, but there are some magnificent set pieces in the film. And, you know, they must have constantly been thinking, how do we do a fist fight that's going to be a bit different to the last one? We'll use a sofa.
A sofa, a helicopter. Mm. Whereas in the Roger Moore ones, it was like, should we do a train again? This time Jaws is in the cupboard.
Yeah. Or a lift. We could do a lift. I've done one of them for a while.
Yeah. But eventually he beats up all the guys. Aki gets away, but then he gets captured. He gets knocked out and taken to Helga Brandt. And when he wakes up, he's sat in a chair and he's tied to the chair. And he admits, all right, I admit it. I'm a spy. I've stolen Asato's secret MSG recipe. And if you go in with me, I'll split the money with you. Because industrial secrets are big business.
Which I think is it actually an MSG recipe?
I have no idea. I hope so.
It's just monosodium glutamate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, it's in a long line of preposterous ways to get away from being captured.
But at least he's thinking on his feet.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, it's like, I mean, Goldfinger. It makes no sense in the book. It makes a tiny bit more sense in the film. But it's kind of, you know, I'm an enemy secret agent, an assassin who's been sent here to kill you. But why don't we just go into business together?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's maybe a good idea, Mr. Bond.
No, Mr. Bond, I want you to take 40%. So Brandt then sort of plays me his own game and goes along with him and has sex with him. And then she says, we'll go off in a plane together. And when they're in the plane, she then sort of straps this plank of wood across them and jumps out. But luckily, what she didn't realise is that not only did he study Oriental languages at Cambridge, it came with a night course in judo chops. Because he smashes through the plank and then safely lands the crashing plane.
Yeah, so this was this would have been before the sort of my mind's gone blank. Not Jackie Chan, the other fella.
Bruce Lee.
That was more 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, so, I think late 60s, early 70s, but I think before, yeah.
There obviously was an interest in that whole the start of the sort of obsession with the Eastern martial arts kind of vibe.
But it obviously wasn't as big because I think if it was a bigger cultural thing, it would be in this a lot more. Because by the time you get to The Man with the Golden Gun, it's in it a lot. And obviously Live and Let Die.
Yeah, that very much. That was totally, totally on the back of the whole kung fu craze.
Because when they do mirror what's going on culturally, they don't just mirror it, they kind of rip it off.
Yes.
And they haven't really done that here as much as it just to be a kind of dressing rather than a whole ethos of the film. So he goes back to Tanaka's and there's good news. They've identified the coastline from the photograph. It's an island called Matsu. So then Bond, he'd previously messaged that he wants Tanaka to contact British HQ and tell him to bring little Nellie and her father. And when it arrives, Tanaka seems a bit disappointed that it's not a lady, that it's actually a plane. And then we get Q, lovely Q, who's the father. And he explains that little Nellie is, in fact, a small sort of helicopter plane thing.
A gyrocopter.
Which was obviously a working thing.
It was, and the guy that flew it in the film. Mm-hmm. It was his invention.
Yeah,
and I remember at the time he was on a lot of TV shows. And
I bet he was
talking about this, and he was exactly what you wanted. He was a sort of mustachioed, posh RAF type.
Yeah,
who was slightly bonkers.
Yeah,
and he was obviously hoping on the back of this that the production lines would be rolling and they'd be making hundreds of these things.
He probably thought it would take off. I don't think they did because it looks quite unsafe when you see it now.
Yeah, well, I mean, the helicopters all round were quite unsafe in the film. Mm. There was the was he the cinematographer or a cameraman who had actually had his foot sliced off.
His foot sliced off.
I think in the magnetized car sequence,
yes.
The helicopter got too close together. And yeah, it sliced through the side of the helicopter. So helicopters are always a nightmare and need to be steered well clear of, and particularly a little tiny one. In the film, going back to my boyhood self, you think, oh my God, this is just the best thing ever. It's got rockets, it's got everything. And
it's
of course,
aerial mines.
Yes. James Bond is just going to basically blow everybody out of the sky.
Mm. And he does.
But does he actually go anywhere on it? I can't.
He flies to the volcano.
Oh, and he has a look round, yes.
This is one of those classic examples, because he goes to the volcano and he's like, oh, well, there's nothing here, I'm going to go now. And then he gets attacked and it's like, well, why did you do that? Because he was going to go and not say anything. But now you've made him think. Yeah. But yeah, he takes them all out quite quickly with his rockets and his aerial mines, which are little mines with parachutes on them. And he takes them all out. He comes back and... when he gets back, he lands, and then we cut to the Russians launching their next rocket. And again, it gets eaten by a capsule.
Mm. So the idea is, yes, that the Russians will blame the Americans and the Americans will blame the Russians. They'll both go to war.
Mm-hmm.
And Spectre will be able to clean up on the back of it.
I've never understood in what way.
Profit, you know.
Oh,
profits
right.
From war.
Profits from war.
Massive. There's massive profits to be made from war, particularly if you're making armaments, munitions, that kind of thing.
Aerial mines.
Yes.
Yeah.
Rockets inside volcanoes.
Yeah.
You sell them to everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Thank you. So then we get to see the rocket not only, as you mentioned earlier, not only take the capsule, but also come back to the volcano and land safely.
Mm.
Which is something that Elon Musk does now.
Yes.
Except the rocket doesn't call anyone a paedophile. So that's the one key difference. So inside the crater, we get to see Ken Adams' set, which is the most, until The Spy Who Loved Me, is possibly the most incredible set.
I think it's better than The Spy Who
Loved Me. I think it is as well.
Because it is such a total fantasy.
Yeah. And also,
The Spy Who Loved Me is based on something which exists, the inside of one of these tankers. But that just, I mean, it is an extraordinary set.
Yeah.
It must have been absolutely huge.
Yeah, and it's got a real helicopter landing pad in it that can land actual helicopters. That's how big it is. And mini mokes driving around.
Yeah.
And I think the difference is The Spy Who Loved Me, as you say, is based on a real thing, but also it's built within a set, whereas this, within a hangar type thing, the 007 stage, which at this point didn't exist. So they actually had to build that outside. So I guess that gave them a bit more room to expand it. And yeah, it's a stunning piece of work. Every time you see it, you're just like, bloody hell.
Yeah.
But yeah, you see what they're doing with it. Basically, they bring it back, they kidnap the astronauts, and then they just kind of put the rocket into storage. It's just amazing. But there's one man giving the orders as the workers remove from the capsule, and he's sat in a chair stroking a cat. We can't see his face, but we know who he is. Well, we don't. At the time, you probably didn't.
And that, yes, so up to that point, he hadn't showed his face in any of the films.
No, you've just seen the hand and the cat.
Yes.
And he's known as number one.
Yes, and so there is a great anticipation here of, are we going to see his face and what might he look like?
That's right. And it's not a disappointment. It would have been, because Pleasance wasn't the original casting.
Now, I mean, so many of these films, you look back and what was originally out, you think, oh, my, thank God for that. They didn't do that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so who remind me who the originals that they'd been after. In fact, they started filming with someone, didn't they?
They did, yeah.
He's not a name, was he?
No, I can't remember who it was right now, but he looked like Father Christmas. Yeah, so he just didn't have that sign of... He didn't have that kind of scary thing that Pleasance just has without even speaking.
Oh, but what an actor.
Oh, he's amazing. I recently watched again Deathline, where he plays against type quite severely, but he does it so well.
He was just brilliant in everything that he did. And, you know, what must it have been like in real life was just whatever he did, were people just terrified of him?
Yeah.
If he went to the post office, I'd like to buy some stamps, please. Everyone's... I can't do Donald Pleasant. No. But, you know, because it's a bit like Tommy Cooper. Whatever he did or said, everybody just thought it was a joke and just would piss themselves laughing. Even when he died.
Even when he died.
On stage, they were just erupting with laughter.
God, yeah, I watched that. That was terrifying.
And so, you know, for Donald Pleasant, just wherever he went, people were just shitting themselves.
Yeah. And either that or they thought Michael Myers was nearby. Yeah. So wherever he went, he was screwed.
You think he's bad enough? You wait till you see who's lurking around the corner.
So, yeah, Blofeld removes himself to his quarters with his henchman Hans to feed his piranhas. He's not too happy with Asato and Brandt. He talks to some representatives from China. And this is the bit that made me laugh. He wants to start a war, as you mentioned, between Russia and the United States. And he asks for $100 million in gold. And they're like, that's a bit extortionate. And it's like, well, it's in the name. It's in Spectre that we're extortionists.
Yes.
What are you expecting? Yeah.
Needs to be extortionate.
Exactly. If it's not the other one, it's not one of the other categories. We have to do the extortion.
Otherwise, it would be spurter.
Yeah.
Instead of extortion, it would be reasonableness.
Yeah, and the Trade Description Act will come down as like a ton of bricks.
Hello, my name is Pete Ellison. This is Dave Cribb.
Hello, and we do a podcast called Friends with Friends, as you might have guessed from the music that's playing underneath, which is a sort of lo-fi rendition of the Friends theme tune for rights reasons. We get a different guest on every week on our podcast to talk about their favourite episode of Friends.
And we look through it in excruciating detail. We pick through levels of plot like no one has ever done before.
So if you like Friends or just listening to people talking, which are both valid activities, do look us up on the old podcast apps and that. Friends with Friends, and we're on Twitter at FriendsWF.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
But he kills Brandt because she failed him because she didn't kill Bond in that plane crash.
Yes, she is the classic bad girl that Bond has sex with and then dies horribly.
Well, she gets fed to your piranhas, Charlie, so you must have enjoyed that as a child.
Well, yes. Mm. I mean, it's the sort of thing we've seen a lot of since, that kind of thing. But yeah, how brilliant to have a tank full of piranhas in your office.
Yeah, that's awesome.
With a special retractable bridge over it.
I mean, at some point in the future, Blofeld's going to be sitting there doing some admin. And this skeleton's just going to float to the surface and it's going to be a real nightmare to fish it out.
Or someone's going to knock at the door and he's going to rush across the room to answer it, slip, and he's in his pool.
He's in his pool.
But you also, this can't be the first time he's done this.
No.
Because that retractable bridge was only built for one reason.
Yeah.
You'd think nobody would stand on the bloody thing, particularly if they knew they'd done wrong.
No.
Think, I'm going to stand on the desk.
Yeah. It's all right. You go on. I'll stay here.
Yeah.
So then Bond goes to meet Tiger, and then we meet his team of ninjas.
Yeah.
At the training school. And he gets shown all sort of what they can do. So they could do throwing stars.
Mm-hmm.
They do shooting guns. And they have special cigarettes that fire bullets.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, they've always said smoking can kill.
Yeah.
And it certainly can.
They should use this in the advert. Not that they do that anymore.
Put it on the cigarette packs.
Exactly. Smoking can kill low-level henchmen. Tanaka tells him, look, basically Tanaka says to him, look, Bond, you can get involved in this mission, but to do it, you're going to have to yellow up.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is where the film takes a very, very dodgy turn.
A very dodgy turn, yeah. I mean, it's a bit
which
like,
even at the time was incredibly unconvincing.
Oh, it's awful. It reminds me of that bit in, have you seen Team America?
Yes.
When they dress him up as a Arabic agent and they have this long montage bit and all they've done is stick extra eyebrows on him. I mean, they've just added eyelids to him. Essentially,
yeah, given
him a haircut.
Him a terrible haircut.
Yeah.
And shaved his chest.
And shaved his chest, of course.
Yeah.
Which is an operation in itself.
Yes.
Yeah.
It took apparently 3 days to shave Sean Connery's chest.
And with scaffolding and all sorts. But also, he'll have to get married and establish a deep cover. But the only problem is he'll need a girl from the island. And then Tanaka describes that the girl he's thinking of has a face like a pig.
Hmm.
So you can see Bond thinking, you know, war's all right. I'd rather war than that. So if not for the first time, Bond will have to turn Japanese.
Yes. And get married, because, you know, again, that comes up in quizzes and things about Bond, of like, you know, in what film does he get married? Which is obviously with Diana Rigg in on Her Majesty's Secret Service. But he does get married in this film as well. Yeah. Although, technically, he's not properly married because he uses a false name, I believe.
That's right.
But he still is
Mr.
married.
Mr. Charmaine.
Yeah.
The Benny Hill character.
Yes.
He calls Tanaka an idiot, and they get on with the ceremony.
You silly idiot. Yes. In fact, you know, I remember at the time, not so much, because I wasn't so sensitive to xenophobia,
no,
cultural stereotypes at the time, but I did think this is not right. Bond, he looks stupid.
He does.
This doesn't work for me.
No, if you ignore the fact that it's culturally insensitive, which perhaps in 1967 they weren't as sensitive towards, it looks stupid.
Yes,
he looks a bit like Herman Munster.
Yes.
Which is funny, because when he did Never Say Never Again, he looks like this again because of all the makeup they've applied to him to make him look younger.
And the wig he had to wear as well.
Oh, God, yeah, that thing looks like it'll just elastic band off his head when he takes it off. After the complicated procedure, as they call it, is complete, he then returns to Aki and they go to bed together. And then they get this really tense, well-done poisoning scene.
Oh, yeah, with the thread.
With the thread.
Yes, dripping the thread down.
That's
which
great.
I think must have been based on an actual ninja assassin's
I
technique.
Think it must be, yeah.
And again, that's interesting. I wonder if that came from Dahl or from the other writer or from the producers. But it is. That really stuck in the mind. And
yeah.
I really liked Aki. I still do. I think, she's a great character. And
Bond didn't.
What do you mean he didn't like
her? Well, hours later he was completely turned, his head was turned by another lady and he completely forgot about her.
Well, that was for the mission, you know, he was doing it for Queen and Country.
All right.
Because you can't, you see, that's the thing is Bond, you can't, in this era Bond, it was slightly different with Daniel Craig.
Yeah.
He can't spend half a film mourning.
No,
and,
you're right.
And taking on all the heavy emotional baggage of all these people whose deaths he's caused around him. You've just got to get on to the next set piece. So finding that balance of, oh, that's sad, Aki's dead. Oh, let's get on and see who he's going to marry.
Yeah. No, you're right. I prefer this to mourning over a lady for four films.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But that's the modern world we live in.
It is. Yeah, we have to hold on to our feelings. We can't let them go. Even if it is the detriment of the film.
Yes.
So Aki's dead. Very sad. So then after a training montage, Tanaka says, "We're going to go to the next day and you will be a poor Japanese worker with a humble Japanese wife at your side with a face like a pig." So then he has his mock wedding, as you mentioned earlier. And wouldn't you believe it, the lady turns up. She hasn't got a face like a pig or indeed any other animal. She's a nice lady.
She's a human being.
Yeah, imagine that.
Oh, that's a clever comedy twist.
What it should have been, of course, was Sean Connery in drag. Just for comedy purposes. But it's not. It's a nice lady. And they're married in a traditional ceremony by a man who looks like Japan's premier Ronnie Corbett impersonator.
Benny Hill wasn't free.
Benny Hill was not free. He was filming the Benny Hill movie at the time. And his new wife's called Kissy.
Kissy Suzuki.
Yeah. What a great name.
Yeah, on some levels.
On some levels, yeah. I know it's just things they've looked out of the window in Japan and seen. But yeah.
A great Bond girl name.
That's awesome.
Kissy Suzuki.
Yeah.
But she sort of is essentially Aki come back to life. In
she
many
is
ways,
Aki
isn't
again.
She?
Yeah.
And you kind of, and yes, the poisoning scene is quite powerful and memorable. Mm. But you do kind of think maybe it would have been better if they've actually just kept Aki for the whole film.
Yeah. He'd have been happily married to Aki.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then they go back to her house and she says, "You'll sleep over there, I'll sleep over here." And he's like, "Oh, we should sleep in the same bed. You know, we're kind of married."
And I am James Bond.
Yeah. And then she says, "Oh, no, we can't do that." And then he says, "Oh, well, I won't be eating these then." And he pushes the oysters she's made from away. I mean, what a prick.
Well, I know. Come on. She was sending really mixed messages there. She's given him oysters and then told him to sleep in a different bed. Come on.
All right. I'll admit. So with another girl, apparently, has disappeared. Kissy tells him.
One of the pearl fishers.
Yeah. Another pearl fisher has gone missing. A lot of women have gone missing in this area near the caves. So he says, "We're going to go and look at some caves." And they're
actually
going there.
While we're talking about the pearlfishers, that is one of the memorable scenes and descriptions in the book is the swimming with these pearlfishers, and that was based on something that Ian Fleming had actually researched, possibly even had witnessed down there. That he was very excited by the fact that they didn't really wear anything; they just had these small black triangles. That was it, held on with a couple of bits of string.
Goodness.
And it's one of his it's James Bond as read by 14-year-olds as introduction to the world of sex and violence. That was a well-thumbed page, his description of following
nudie ladies,
these nude ladies underwater and being entranced by the little black triangles.
Goodness.
Anyway. Back to the film.
Yeah, let's go back to the film. Yeah, yeah. Before we all get too stimulated. Before you get to drop another one of your catchphrases. I've just come. So they go into the cave. Bond spots gas in the air. And so they go underneath and then they go through the tunnels and they come out and there's this big hill going towards the volcano. And he says to Kissy, "Do you fancy coming up a hill?" And she says, "Yep." And then halfway up, they get... She asks for a rest, and then he seduces her. Meanwhile, down at the bottom of the mountain, Aki's funeral was attended by many sad family members who all miss her deeply. But then halfway through their kissing, they spot a helicopter fly overhead. But then it seems to descend into the volcano and disappear. What's going on?
Is that possible?
I don't know. So they go to the top of the volcano to have a look, and of course there's nothing there. So as the Americans are launching their latest rocket, Bond and his Kissy discover that the bottom of the crater is metal and they watch as it opens to launch another helicopter. And he says to Kissy, "Go back to get Tanaka." And every man he's got, and he sneaks inside with these kind of suction cup things.
Yes.
Which is cool. He's like Spider-Man.
Yeah.
He Spider-Man's his way in.
And who didn't want suction cups?
No one. No, I want. I saw Superman the movie when I was a kid, and I wanted them. Yeah. The one the burglars had.
Well, when I was doing Randall Hotcut Deceased with Vic and Bob, we had Simon Pegg actually using suction cups.
Wow.
As an assassin to try and get to Bob Mortimer's room to assassinate him.
Wow.
We had a lot of fun in the dub doing suction cup effects.
And how did you achieve it?
A bit of mouth work. Uh-huh. Bit of Foley work.
Right, sure.
A bit of everything. But it's fantastic fun to actually get to make programs where, and I always loved these sort of big fantasy things.
Mm.
Like I used to watch in the 60s, there's great shows like The Avengers and The Prisoner and The Champions and all these things. And so I've always wanted to try and do all that stuff that you watched as a kid and put it into TV things. So, you know, suction cups, quicksand, all those kind of things.
Are you on the Loads of Money record?
Yes.
Yes, because that was one of the first singles I bought.
I often wondered what idiots bought that.
I did.
Yeah, you know, you look back at the novelty singles and you think, why did people buy them? But they did.
I bought so many, yeah.
But actually, if you strip out the bits, the parts that me, Harry and Paul did, the actual backing is a very solid dance track, because we wrote it and it was produced by William Orbit.
Of course, yeah.
Who, went on to be one of the biggest producers in the world.
Yeah.
And make a lot of amazing, amazing music. And when we did Top of the Pops, he actually joined us there.
Oh, that's who it was.
Playing the keyboards, yeah.
Oh. That was a weird time, wasn't it?
What, the past?
The past. The whole Loads of Money thing. It was a very strange time.
Yeah, well, it was. I mean, you know, it was incredible how quickly it took off. And then how quickly it went.
Yeah.
Well, Harry did. He killed him off. He didn't want
to do it.
He did. His total screen time, probably, for Loads of Money from beginning to end, was about half an hour.
Yeah.
But that was the power of live TV. And Saturday Night Live, we hadn't really had anything like that in the country.
It was very exciting for me at the time. Definitely.
Yeah, and it was exciting for everyone. It's an amazing thing to make. It was going out live, had all these great bands on, and people were seeing all the sort of alternative comedy acts for the first time and using them and showing them there, and it went out live, so the energy in the studio and the pressure on the performers was extraordinary, and Harry and Ben Elton really just coped with that extremely well. And because it was live, so we could do Loads of Money one week, my God, it's taken off, people are talking about it, and you can feed that back in and reference that and build on it the very next week.
Wow.
So you get the amazing sort of feedback loop between what's going on in the public and the tabloids and all that stuff, the way it got taken on. It eventually ended up being used by first Neil Kinnock.
Yeah.
And then Mrs. Thatcher, Margaret Thatcher, in Parliament.
That's right.
Said, "We have been accused of being a Loads of Money economy. Well, what's wrong with that?" I suppose she'd never seen the character.
Yeah, that's that fucked up.
But it does mean that our catchphrase is in the Hansard, our official parliamentary record of our Loads of Money catchphrase. So it's great to be part of British history.
Absolutely. Yeah, God, yeah, that's a very exciting time, though.
It was.
Especially, I remember the Dangerous Brothers got banned.
Well, it was quite dangerous.
It was. Yeah. Anyway,
but you know, as that was the first TV that Paul and I did, and to do that as your first thing was just, and we always thought, well, that's what TV is. Then you write it on a Monday, you rehearse it during the week, and it goes out on a Friday or Saturday, and we'd go down to the studio when it was going out and just get drunk and watch it. We'd have the pressure of actually performing on it. So
didn't it all come from doing some work on Fry and Laurie's house?
Well, not exactly. Right. It all happened kind of at the same time. I mean, Paul and I did actually. Because Harry was working with Stephen and Hugh on I think the first series of Saturday Night Live that Paul and I weren't involved with. Paul and I were working as decorators and plasterers. We were old friends of Harry's.
Mm-hmm.
He said to Stephen and Hugh, "Oh, get my mates in. They'll They can decorate your house. They'd bought a house together.
Yeah.
So we did. It was a great job. Nice big house in Dalston in East London. And of course, Paul and I would whilst we were there, we would sort of do funny voices and amusing comedy routines as we were decorating and pretend to be sort of East End builders, like loads of money, in the hope that one of Stephen and Hugh would say, "Well, you're absolutely marvellous. Here's a lot of money. Go and make a television programme." But we did. We managed to make an appearance. There was one episode where Stephen is teaching Hugh, or Hugh is teaching Stephen. One of them is teaching the other about rock and roll and boogie woogie. Mm-hmm. And Hugh wanted to finish the piece by actually going into a proper boogie woogie number on the piano with a little band. Mm. And so Paul and I said, "Well, we can be your band." Mm-hmm. I got the bass player from my old band, the Higgsons, in. Mm-hmm. Paul's a good guitarist. I played some very simple drums. Mm-hmm. And we dressed up as the standard. Young people won't know what we're talking about, but often on variety shows you'd have music acts and they'd have like the BBC in-house light orchestra,
yeah,
a variety orchestra. So there'd be men in roll necks with thick glasses and very large headphones,
yeah,
with very serious expressions on their face, studiously playing the rock and roll and reading it off sheet music.
Yeah.
So we dressed up as that. And that was our first time on TV, actually. Well, on comedy TV, was being Hugh's backing band. And we did encourage Hugh after that. We actually played a few live gigs with him. We put together a proper band. And I kind of think that we put him on his path to...
He eventually
did it all properly with some fairly major musicians. But he always loved playing the piano.
Oh, well, it was all very good. But talking of music...
Yes.
We see a shot of space and we get John Barry's Capsule in Space Cue.
Yeah.
Which is one of his finest pieces. And I looked it up. Apparently it's an ostinato.
Ostinato, yeah. What does that mean?
It's the kind of music it is.
Oh, you've really done in-depth research here.
I'm blinding you with science.
Ostinato,
I'm so sorry.
It's a way, isn't it? Kind of like a way of...
It's a kind of music.
...playing.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that is. Mm. I mean, one of the first records I ever bought was a John Barry double album compilation. And it had all the classics of Born Free and the James Bond theme and the Silvercrin advert.
The Ipcress File.
Ipcress File,
Midnight,
yes.
Midnight Cowboy.
Seance in a Wet Afternoon. Mm. Yeah, all of that. And it had Space Capsule used to be on all the compilations.
It's such an amazing
Capsule
piece of
in
music.
Space. It is such a classic Bond piece of music and a John Barry piece of music. Yeah.
It's the great thing.
I mean, I love the music for the film. It is one of my favourite theme songs, which we skipped over.
We did. Yeah, I meant to mention that earlier, actually. We could talk about it now because it was basically the 11th hour rewrite.
Yes. And again, Nancy Sinatra wasn't a first choice. They had to be persuaded to let her do it. And John Barry was really clever at, he'd put kind of three themes together at the same time. So you had more than one hook.
Yes.
So you have all the da 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 and the actual melody as well underneath or over the top and all this stuff mixing together.
Yeah.
A fabulous piece of music.
It was originally a song written with Julie Rogers singing.
The great Julie Rogers.
The great Julie Rogers, yeah. Where is she now? But you can find it on YouTube and it's just not as good. It's very clunky Japanese sounding.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas this is sweeping and...
Yeah, you've got the little sort of plucked bit at the start to give it a slight Japanese flavour and then it's like, actually, let's just get on and do a real stonking tune.
But it was literally like, I think if he hadn't have had that, I think the producers said they didn't like it that much, but I think it would have probably gone through. But from what I remember with interviews from him, he was literally like, I don't like it. I'm going to just wipe it and start again. Mm. Very late in the day. And it's just a masterpiece. I think it's my favourite Bond. Well, Live and Let Die is my favourite, but the favourite Barry piece.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I think it may well be mine as well. Yeah. And but as we were saying before, there were so many near misses.
Yeah.
Through the whole history of all of this.
Yeah.
I mean, talking of theme tunes, you know where the actual James Bond theme originated, Monty Norman.
It's a song, I can't, it's from
it was from
musical
he was doing. About India, and it was originally written to be played on a sitar.
That's right. It was called a room for Mr. Something or other.
A house for Mr. Biswas.
House for Mr. Biswas.
Once you hit, say, well, you know, that twangy plucked guitar was sitar.
Yes.
And that moody, the way the one note in a chord goes up and down. Mm. Again, it was sort of influenced by Eastern music, and the way that then becomes changed, and you know, Barry brings in elements of swing and rock and roll and orchestral, and just all that coming together. That's extraordinary.
That's where you get that grey area, isn't it? Because it's Monty Norman's theme, but if John Barry hadn't have orchestrated it, then perhaps it wouldn't be as classic as it is today.
And maybe there would have been no films after Dr. No.
Possibly.
You know, the conjunction of the severes of that, of Sean Connery, John Barry, Ken Adam.
Yeah.
Those three coming together.
And, Broccoli and Saltzman, who clearly had a vision.
Yes.
And were very pure to the source material as well.
Yeah. But, you know, they'd had things that had been hits, they'd had things that had been misses. The film was a sort of a B-movie. It was a sort of sci-fi movie, really, at the time. They took a punt on it, and lo and behold, they invented a whole new style of cinema.
Yeah, I do admire the fact that they didn't give in to temptation and Americanize it or change it in any way. I'm guessing Fleming had some influence in that as well.
Fleming was he'd do anything to get it made.
That's true.
When they did the first version of Casino Royale back in 1953,
a
live TV movie where James Bond was American.
Yeah.
Played by Barry Nelson.
Jimmy Bond.
Called Jimmy Bond, and Felix Leiter is a posh Englishman from the British Secret Service. But they did get Peter Lorre to play Le Chiffre, which was quite a coup. Yeah. Anyway, back to You Only Live Twice.
You Only Live Twice. So the capsule in space goes up. It nicks another rocket, basically, and brings it back. But Bond sneaks into the holding cells. And then takes the place of one of the astronauts that's going to go up in the next rocket. Mm-hmm. And as he's on the way into the elevator, he's carrying his air filtration tank. And Blofeld's like, stop that astronaut. Bring him to me. Send in the reserve astronaut. I really like that. And so he has to go and see number one. When he gets there, there's a lovely piece of blocking here. Because when he walks in the room, Hans walks in front of Donald Pleasance. But it's from behind. So you're thinking yourself at first, why has he done that? But of course, when you're showing it from the front, it allows Donald Pleasance to then lean to the side of Hans and reveal his face. Mm-hmm. And it's brilliant. And yes, the original actor to play him was called Jan Werish, a Czech actor.
Right.
But he did look like Father Christmas, so it wasn't very good. But he said, I've heard you were assassinated. And then Bond says, that was my first life. And then he says, you only live twice, Mr. Bond.
That's such
a great line.
It is, but they probably spent hours working. How do we cram this in?
Beggar's belief. Luckily, they don't do that with every film. So he says to Bond, you know, you're going to stay in here with me and you're going to watch this and nothing's going to happen. We're going to create this whole new world order and a superpower will arise from the ashes. So his capsule, Bird One, which is covered in Russian writing to make the Americans angry, is ready for a launch, and the crater lid opens. But then, as it opens, Tanaka and these super ninjas are outside.
And they rappel down.
They do. Well, first they get completely destroyed by machine gun fire.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't seem like a good plan. But they manage to make their way in. Because that's when Bond shoots one of the men with a exploding cigarette.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
And it's the battle we've been waiting for.
We have, my goodness.
Two properly colour-coordinated groups of henchmen, so
Thank
we can
God.
Tell them apart. Mm-hmm. Coming down on ropes from the top of this amazing set, and there's people on monorail trains and all kinds of stuff.
It's like Chessington World of Adventures, isn't there?
It is.
There's someone doing a loop-the-loop roller coaster going past. But yeah, everyone gets grenade happy. They start chucking grenades everywhere.
Yeah, and there's great grenade shots where three stuntmen fly over a high wall.
Yeah, it's
come
so
tumbling
good.
Down. Yeah.
But then Blofeld shuts the shutters on their room and says they are now impregnable and nothing can prevent the rocket apart from this button that I'm now going to tell you about, which needs a key to operate. But don't worry about that. So yeah, there's chaos going on outside. Then Zane Blofeld takes Bond outside to a secret tunnel and he's about to execute him. Goodbye, Mr. Bond. But Tanaka throws a throwing star into his wrist.
Excellent.
So
we've
good.
We've seen a throwing star earlier. What do we want to see? We want to see that thrown at someone.
It's Chekhov's throwing star.
Yes.
So then Blofeld buggers off, basically. And so Bond and Tanaka head back to the control room to stop the capsule. And but, of course, the key is with Hans. So Bond does a punch-up with Hans and eventually chucks him into the piranhas as well before getting the key. And then presses the button just at the last minute with 5 seconds to spare and saves the world.
Yeah, so we got one of those classic Bond countdowns.
Yeah, but at least it's not wrong like the Goldfinger one.
Well, I always, you know, it's a bugbear of mine, the countdown, which is used in so many movies.
Mm.
And I automatically, as soon as it starts, I start counting.
Yeah.
And you kind of think, you know, it wouldn't have been that hard in the edit to put the numbers in that actually do follow the actual time of how long this takes.
Yes.
And don't say you've got a minute and then someone has to do something which takes at least 10 minutes and you couldn't do it any quicker.
Yeah.
To do, but and the seconds go down incredibly slow. You think, well, why don't you just say 10 minutes?
Yeah.
And but that's a thing of mine.
Well, I watched this with my 8-year-old son today, and as the counter goes down from, I think it's 20 seconds or something like that, he suddenly said to me, they'd all be dead by now. I've been counting in my head, and there's still loads of it to go.
And it draws you out as soon as they say that.
Yeah.
But I mean, what the fight does here very cleverly, which is you have to do in these battles, is you've got a huge battle going on, but you have to make it personal for Bond.
Yes.
He has to do something one-on-one, something significant, rather than just charge around throwing grenades and firing machine guns.
Yeah.
And so that's always the tricky thing in an action sequence is to give your individual characters an actual individual purpose. And they usually pull it off pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got no problem with the climax of this one. There's a few of them later on where they go a bit wrong, but I really like this one. And also Blofeld's like, well, fuck you all then, because he gets off his monorail and turns on the self-destruct. Which seems to be just lots of lava coming out.
Well, he's got a volcano.
He has got a volcano. Well, you know, why wouldn't you use it? It's true. But Bond and everybody get away, and then when they're swimming outside of the cave they went into earlier, a plane flies over and drops lots of dinghies for them all to get into. And then he's just about to get it on with Kissy when a submarine submerges. Sorry, not submerges. Emerges. Comes up. Emerges, thank you.
Surfaces,
that's better.
Yes.
Yeah, that comes up. And M basically is like, well, can we stop him having sex on the roof, please? And Moneypenny's like, yeah,
Killjoy.
No problem. Yeah. He's had to watch Bond having sex so many times. He's sick of it.
You'd think he would learn, wouldn't he?
He would. I mean, you know, from Russia with Love, when they have to stop the tape when Bond starts talking about what him and M got up to in Hong Kong. he's seen it enough. And then it ends. And the one of the things I loved most about Bond films in the old days is it says, James Bond will return in On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Yes.
God, I used to love that. I used to stay to the end of the credits even though I knew what the next film was. I just love it coming up.
Well, it's confirmed.
Mm.
And you think, I'm going to have this much fun again.
Yes. There's only one film where it's wrong.
Which one's that?
At the end of The Spy Who Loved Me, it says James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only. Mm-hmm. But they did Moonraker instead because of Star Wars.
Yeah. The Fools.
The Fools. So, Charlie, that's the end of You Only Live Twice.
It felt like we only lived about 10 times then. Sorry, I did bang on a bit, but
I do love
talking about James Bond.
So do I, as you imagine, and I enjoyed you banging on.
Good.
I'm sure everybody at home did too. But we've reached the stage of the podcast.
If they didn't, they won't have actually got to that bit, so it doesn't matter.
Exactly. Fuck them anyway. we've reached the point of the podcast where I ask quick fire questions.
Yeah, I wish I would be able to give you quick fire answers.
No, it's fine because I've got editing equipment. So I can fast show you through it.
Right.
So Charlie Higson, what's your favourite Bond film?
Well, as I say, a personal favourite that meant a lot to me, You Only Live Twice, is really up there.
Mm-hmm.
But I do love Dr. No,
mm-hmm.
because it was the first, and because as a kid, whenever a new Bond movie came out, you'd get a double bill, and they would always put Dr. No on before. So I saw that so many times.
Right.
And in those days, you wouldn't look at showing times. You'd just turn up at the cinema and you'd come in halfway through a film. Mm. There'd be a sort of industrial film on, like, The Wonders of Gravel. And you'd get a supporting film. And so Dr. No, I saw so many times, but it was only quite a lot later I actually sat down and watched it from beginning to end in the right order. Mm. But it was such a part of my childhood.
Yeah.
So I loved them. But actually, you know what I'm going to go for?
Mm-hmm.
I told you I couldn't give you a quick answer.
Go on.
I think I'm going to say Casino Royale.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yes, the Daniel Craig one.
Right.
Because it is such a fantastic film, and it was such an amazing way to bring back Bond. And it was clever the way that they reimagined it and updated it to work with a contemporary audience. It's got some great sequences in it. I think Daniel Craig is excellent.
Yes, he is.
David Arnold's music is amazing.
It's phenomenal.
The ending of that film is just so exciting, where he finally says the name is Bond, and for the first time in the film the theme bangs in.
Yeah.
And you think, my God, I have just watched the longest pre-title sequence ever. It's an entire 2-hour film.
Yeah.
And the excitement coming out of that, again, we're talking about Bond will return. You think, oh my God, they've done it so well, they've set it up so well.
Mm.
When he comes back in the next film, it is going to be amazing.
Hmm.
Which brings me to your second question.
What's your least favourite Bond film?
It has to be Quantum of Solace. You know, you could say Moonraker, but it's got a camp fun to it. But Quantum of Solace was such a major disappointment after they got everything right in Casino Royale to just chuck it out the window, to be swayed by what the director wanted to do. And to come up with a film that is incoherent, I can't even remember who the villain was in it, or the girl, or the story. Yes, as you say, it was something to do with water.
Yeah.
It made little sense. You couldn't tell what was going on in most of it. And you just thought, oh, what? Mm. What have they done?
I'm afraid so.
So I think for the sense of disappointment that film gave, and the fact that it will never be on your list of, oh yeah, Quantum of Solace, let's have another watch of that.
No.
There you go.
Yeah, they seem to be on a kind of Star Trek run with the new ones. It's like Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, Skyfall, Spectre.
Yes, I won't say anymore.
Yeah, no, don't say anymore.
I mean, it is interesting though in the Bond films that it goes cyclical. They start with your Dr. No or whatever. It's stripped back. It's true to the book.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's about character. It's about who Bond is. It tells a story. And then they think, we've got to just top it a little bit in the next one and up it a bit and up it a bit and up it a bit. You get to You Only Live Twice. You've got the villain in a volcano.
Yeah.
You've got the gyrocopter. You've got all that stuff. And then it sort of implodes and they say, let's strip it right back and go back to basics, which they did with Her Majesty's Secret Service, which would have been certainly a contender for favourite film.
Yeah.
Except, of course, I'm not a fan of Lazenby.
Sure.
But then, you know, it happened with the Roger Moore films. You get up and up and up to Moonraker and then go back to basics with For Your Eyes Only.
So yeah.
You've had that cycle, and Casino Royale was very much the first in a cycle. Actually, another contender for worst one would have been Die Another Day, which was the peak of the ridiculous Brosnan.
It's the end of the cycle, as you say. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, David Arnold is a good friend of mine.
Mm.
And he said, you know, he said, I'm sitting there trying to score a piece for a man driving an invisible car through a hotel made of ice, firing laser beams. You kind of think, what? This isn't James Bond. This has all gone horribly wrong.
Well, I felt very sorry for him on that one, because it felt like they kind of, they brought him on Tomorrow Never Dies, and he brought back the Barry-esque-ness of Bond.
Mm.
And then World Is Not Enough, it felt like they handed him the keys and said, look, you can do the theme, which you're going to weave through the film like Barry used to.
Mm.
And then with Die Another Day, they're like, Madonna's doing the theme. You can't possibly replicate that in any of your score.
No.
So I felt really sorry for him on that front.
Yeah, it's a shame, because he loves to. If you look at Casino Royale, he said in the writing of that, because the theme doesn't come in at the beginning.
No.
And he said, whenever Bond does an iconic thing for the first time, like put on the
tuxedo,
go into the casino, a little bit of the theme gets introduced.
Mm.
And he kept building that up and adding bits in, you know, until you get to that end moment where finally he has become Bond and he has earned the right to the Bond theme tune, and it's and it hammers in and you just think, oh yes.
But he also weaves in You Know My Name all the way through, which is a great little substitute for the Bond theme, because it's literally him saying, you know who I am, this is what I'm going to do. And then he earns it, as you say, by the end. So, it's a shame. I wish he was still doing them, because he's great. We won't go into that, though.
Yes.
Yes. let's go to the next question. Can you give me your made-up Bond film title?
Well, you see, there's a tricky one for me. Because I wrote the five young Bond books, I spent a lot of time trying to come up with iconic James Bond book stroke film titles for those
books.
I'd be
interested to know your process for that as well, because a lot of people
I wasn't good at it. All the titles I came up with were rejected. I mean, in the end, for Silverfin, we'd spent weeks and gone through every permutation, and we sort of analysed the films, and we said, well, you know, gold has been used a lot, so why don't we try and get silver into the title?
So you didn't do the kind of old timey expressions that you've made a slight change to?
I tried a bit of that, but it didn't seem to really work, because I'm going to find the right expression. And also with kids, those expressions wouldn't necessarily mean anything to them. So it was basically, can we try and make silver work? So we thought silver fish. But that's your sort of those weird sort of bugs you get in damp bathrooms.
Yes.
Silverback. No, that's a gorilla.
Gorilla, yeah.
Silver fist. That sounds like a dodgy sexual practice. So we come up with silver fin. Okay, so that sort of sounds. It's got something of golden eye, something of gold finger, silver fin.
Naval connotations.
It felt about, it sort of felt right. So I then had to work out why it was called silver fin, and I came up with the idea of a Scottish myth about a legendary salmon. Which plays a big part in it. So it actually then became quite nice weaving that into the book. But, you know, I was not great. The closest one we got in the books to a classic Bond title, and we did, we took an existing phrase. This was one actually we came up with a few titles, and we did a vote. The readers could vote on which one, which wasn't revealed until publication day. And they plumped for the one that sounded most like a James Bond film, which was Double or Die.
That's good.
And like James Bond films, it don't really make any sense.
No.
But I meant I could work in a whole casino sequence into the book, which was which was great fun.
Nice.
So, Double or Die. So, yeah, I mean, I've tried to think of some new ones, but I'm slightly burnt out.
Sure.
And I thought, well, you know, you could take already classic Bond films and substitute either Die or Death into it. So you could get You Only Die Once.
Nice.
Or Death is Forever.
I'd go and watch it.
Yeah, Death Finger.
I love it.
Dr. Death.
More will love it.
Or you could take, you know, just put it into TV titles. I did come up with Come Die With Me.
Oh, I really like that, yeah.
So take your pick.
Four in a Grave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brilliant. Okay, so we'll go with Come Die With Me. So Bond is full of silly lady names such as Holly Goodhead, Plenty O'Toole and Penelope Smallbone. Can you give me your best Bond lady name?
Well, again, in my books, they're girls in the books rather than young women. But I did have to come up with names for them, which couldn't be too filthy.
Of course.
And I fared a bit better on that one. I had some good names. I had the first book, she was called Wilder Lawless.
Oh, that's a really good one.
Which I thought I was trying to go with the sort of tough side of the Bond girl. I had Precious Stone.
Oh, classy.
Yeah.
Named after her father, perhaps.
And Amy Goodenough.
Oh, perfect.
I was quite pleased with that one. Again, it's hard to come up with news. I mean, theoretically, you're supposed to take the nickname for your genitals that you had when you were a child, the sort of euphemism for them.
Sure.
And your grandmother's maiden name.
Yes.
I was checking on this, and Daniel Craig does it on Graham Norton. It's on YouTube. But I didn't have a particular nickname for my parts. So my Bond girl is called... I don't think they'd use it.
Okay.
It's... Penis Cullinan.
Definitely named after a father.
Why Pussyfoot? Let's just go for it.
I mean, Pussyfoot's a good name as well, to be honest.
Pussyfoot, yeah, penis, yeah. Pussyfoot.
Okay, and finally, who would you have as James Bond next?
Well, that's a tricky one. And actually, they've always been pretty clever. Daniel Craig came from nowhere. No one would have said Daniel Craig. He was absolutely brilliant. So it's unlikely to be anyone on anyone's list.
Hmm.
Idris Elba would have made a fantastic Bond.
Yeah.
But he would have had to do it 15 years ago, really.
Yeah, he's 52. You've got to start.
I think he's 48.
Oh, is he? I thought he was. Okay.
Something like that. But yeah, you kind of need to be mid-30s, ideally, to start.
Yeah.
The guy I've always really liked, and I think he's a great actor, is James Norton.
Mm.
Who, and really, you know, he played two such different characters. His villain in Happy Valley was just so menacing,
terrifying,
and frightening, and very, very physical, and physically imposing. And then he does the vicar in Grantchester, which has his sort of suave, posh side. So he can do that thing which Daniel Craig has got, that he can be posh and tough at the same time, which is quite tricky. So I think James would make a fantastic Bond.
Good. Okay. I'm sure everyone will be happy with that. It just remains for me to say thank you so much, Charlie Higson, for being here this evening.
It's been great fun reliving my childhood.
Yes. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Goodbye.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Kezia McDonald.
And I'm Ellie Gibson.
And this is our new show, Extra Life.
It's basically us talking to funny people about video games.
When I was a kid, it was Grand Theft Auto.
The Sinclair ZX Spectrum.
We talk about the games people remember from when they were kids and what they're playing now.
Guitar Hero.
The Last of Us 2.
Combat on the Atari 2600.
No, I love Pokemon.
Anyway, find us anywhere you get your podcasts.
Extra Life.
GreatBigOwl.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.